You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Cora Cohen, who's an artist living and working in New York City. Cora, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what's happening in your studio now. What is it that you're working on or exploring at the moment, if I may ask?
I don't really know what I'm doing in my studio right now. I do know what I'm doing, but it seems to be like a lot of different things, and it is a lot of different things. The paintings, I'm very interested in materiality, and some of the paintings I try to make almost things that disappear, like things that take a lot of looking to see, that sort of sink back in to the linen. And I just like that idea. I like it because the world is so, everything seems so bombastic to me, and people speak in sound bites, and there's a kind of hyperbolic quality to so much that I wanted to make paintings that you had to really find, you know, where the viewer becomes sort of an active agent if she or he chooses to. In other words, paintings that don't, you know, come out and hit you over the head.
Right, where there's some subtlety and takes some commitment from the viewer and some investment.
I don't really think of them as subtle. I think that what you're saying back to me from what I said is true. It's not untrue. But I'm not trying to make subtle paintings. I'm trying to make paintings that you could walk right by and not know it was a painting. That's not the only thing I'm trying to make. I've made a couple like that in the past. There were two in particular at, like, in around 2008 that I showed at Michael Steinberg in Chelsea. And then the other thing, but I kind of went back to them as a reaction, as a response, really, to the culture, to the way that it is, and to the way that there's so much art that is very aggressive. So I'd rather think of them as, I don't know the perfect word. And then I'm making the other paintings that aren't that way, and I can talk more about how that they're kind of all, I can talk more about that. I don't know how interesting that is for the world, you know, even people who are involved in art. But, you know, there are some of them, they're mostly based on some of them are based on Linear B script, which was a kind of precursor of Greek, and some of them, and at the same time, there are others that are based on, not based on, but that are kind of inspired by the shapes and forms of Jean Prouvaire. And then there's some that are just like sort of arbitrary writing and drawing. Some of those are works where the mark really sits on top of the linen because the linen is like super primed and super gessoed. So they're very like on the surface and they don't sink in.
I guess you saw the recent show at Gagosian, the Prouvaire show with Chamberlain.
I haven't seen it. It's on my list. I was just, I'm behind in everything, and I was making a list for going out tomorrow. And that's definitely on my list. I became aware of Prouvaire a long time ago. And, you know, he was a really interesting character as well.
So let's move back a little bit to some of your earlier shows. You know, your art is has evolved in so many ways over the years, but at the Everson Museum in, I believe that was 1974, was that your first solo show at a museum?
I think so.
So tell us about that first show and how you approached it. That was obviously, must have been for you, a big moment for an exhibition.
No, you know, I'm not really somebody, I don't really make shows. I make paintings, and then somehow they go out there. I think, you know, it's part of my job is to make it so that they go out there, but I don't really configure a show. I think, you know, I don't know what that, I just don't think that way. I mean, and there's a kind of way that many of my shows don't really cohere, you know, on a formal level. In other words, there aren't a lot of paintings that look alike. There are paintings that are about some of the same things, but they're not organized in any way their morphology is not consistent. They don't look alike. I think if you think about, I think I'm kind of old school, like I just make my work. You know, I just make the paintings and I want, especially places I go, like places I feel attached to, like New York, where I live, I feel like I want to have them out. So then usually, you know, that happens.
So let's talk about that, because you said there's this notion on one hand of making a work without thought of how it's coming together for an exhibition, yet exhibitions happen, and as you said, that's part of your work. If you accepted that's part of your work, to kind of get them out there to be possibly exhibited. What is that work, and how does that work get accomplished when it seems counter to what's happening in the studio?
You know, this is like really funny. You know how they have in schools now, they have these courses like how to be a professional artist or something, and you know what I mean. I was teaching somewhere that will go nameless, and I wanted to keep teaching there, and they said, well, we'd like you to do a course in professional development. And I said, who, me? I said, I'm the wrong person. You should ask Jeff Koons. You should ask, you know, there are all these people who are involved in a kind of thinking of their work as something that they have to promote. And, you know, there's that whole elevator pitch thing. And, you know, then there are also, you know, there is work that almost becomes the elevator pitch, like someone like Damien Hirst. And then, you know, where it's one-liners. And that, I mean, not all work is that way, of course. But I think that I'm not really, the way that first show happened, to answer your question directly, is when I got my master's degree at Bennington College, I had students, because to get money, you were supposed to teach, and I had some students and whom I became friendly with, and we shared a lot, and there wasn't such a big age difference. And one of them, who is still a friend of mine, and her name is Liz Phillips, and she does work in sound, and she was somehow, she knew the Everson at that time, what that was run by Jim Harris, was very like sort of keyed into people like Nam June Paik and Yoko Ono and Charlotte Mormon. And my friend Liz was kind of a protege of a lot of those people. I don't know if protege is the right word. I think she taught them a lot. But at any rate, she decided that Jim Harris would like my work, and she dragged him to my studio. And that's how that show happened.
And throughout your career, is that how other shows happened, more or less? You know, this isn't a professional development interview, but it's interesting to know how, you know, given the way you work, those kind of things do evolve, and how you interact, how the work does get out, so to speak, into
right.
the world.
Well, you know, in the olden days, you know, and of course that's in quotes, but there were more people you could easily speak with, and so you just had conversations, and then if a lot of what you're about and a lot of what you do is your work, then you want people to see what you're doing, and then you, if it's not anywhere public, you invite them to see it. And, you know, that's kind of how some of it came about. And then, you know, sometimes it seems like there's a place that would be interesting for my work. And then I kind of think about that and try to make a kind of bridge to that. And, you know, but I'm not, I'm a pretty casual person in a way, and I think that's why it's good to sort of talk to people and get to know them a little bit, and then it kind of happens naturally.
That makes sense. That sounds very
well. I think it's also, you know how, I mean, I think it's also a different, I come from a different era. I come from a time when people had more time, and things were a little bit more open. I don't know if it, I think it's very difficult now. I mean, I think it's harder now to be a young painter in New York City than it was then, but in some ways, though they do have the young people do have community that, you know, is usually they've come from graduate school, so they have that community. But at any rate, I think my model is from another period. And sometimes it still is, you know, sometimes it still is operative.
Yeah, I think it is operative. I mean, it makes sense that I think building relationships in general is the way to introduce your work and yourself to more people so it's known. Otherwise, you know, how would we know what's happening with different artists? Are you also teaching as well now?
I still teach some. Much less than I used to. I once had a real job for 5 years where I taught, you know, full time, and then mostly now I do visiting artist things and lectures and what they like to call critique, which I don't really believe in. You know, I think it's just good to sit around and talk about the work. And I also teach privately. I have a group of people who I met most of them when I was teaching at another institution, and then that place changed how they handled their continuing ed part and their it just, and so they asked me if I, you know, meet with them, and so that started. And I think, you know, for me with teaching, I think what I found when I started, when I was much younger, I really, really worked hard in a certain way at teaching. And then what I found was that if I just talked to people about what I thought without a million references and without a lot of effort, that was sort of the most beneficial. And for me, with these people who are closer to my, I think it's also interesting generationally. I mean, I really, really value the friendships I have with young people who were either whom I met when I was doing a talk or whom I met, you know, here and there or in teaching. And I learn a lot from them. And, you know, they, like Linda Nochlin once, I remember her giving a lecture and, you know, she, and then I was, I know her a little bit, and I was talking to her afterwards, and she said, well, you know, at that age, and, you know, because I was saying how they seemed, their questions were so good and everything, and she said, and they were like, you know, 30, 25, and she said, well, you know, at that age, they know everything. And mm-hmm. and it is a little bit like that, and then, you know, people kind of lose that, that crystal clear, really distilled. They have a very distilled take on things, and it's really a privilege to know to hear them. And then, you know, it can. I mean, I've taught at a lot of institutions, and I think, you know, sometimes it gets a little, it became that I got a lot of these super overachievers as students. And, you know, if you told them to go, you know, I'll go look at Mary Miss or go look at, you know, Agnes Martin or, you know, go something like that, they'd like come back in 5 minutes and they'd say, oh, I researched all that. What should I do now? You know, and, you know, or I looked at Agnes Martin and I found, you know, John McCracken or, you know, some, and now what? And it's like they just wanted a lot of, I don't know what, teaching, you know, and in some way I'm not really a teacher. You know, I can have a dialogue, but I can't, you know, I can't, and I'm a terrible, terrible undergrad teacher for things that where you have to tell them what to do, like how to mix colors or how to do this or how to, I'm like really, it's so boring to me, and I never really learned it properly anyway.
But you've maintained yourself as a full-time artist all these years, which is a pretty extraordinary accomplishment.
I was really lucky in some ways. In many ways, I had, for certain times, I had supportive galleries, and I also had, and, you know, maybe I should have put this first, I had a really good space for very little money, and I could live on very little money because it was possible to. And I kind of went, you know, really little money. And then I remember one year I came back from Europe and I had like $500 in the bank. That was it. And I called all my friends who had real jobs and I said, you know, can you do something? Can you like give me something? And they, you know, and one of them said, oh, we have like, it's very little money, but you could have this, you know, semester and I'm going on leave and you can take my job and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was very little money, but I could manage on that. And so, you know, and if I sold something for like $7,000, it was like I could really stretch that $7,000, you know, and the numbers are very different. I mean, I kind of went from painting to painting and, you know, small job to small job, and my life isn't that different. It's just the numbers are a little bit different. I mean, I still don't have a kind of security that I think, you know, I mean, I think that that's also, I don't know that I'd paint the same way if I had, and it's not like I wouldn't like more, but, you know, it's just the way it is.
Yeah, that is just the way it is for so many artists. There isn't much of a safety net at all.
No, and I also feel very fortunate that, you know, some people show my work and some people sell my work and some people buy my work. And, you know, some of those, as my numbers have gotten higher, some of those numbers have gotten higher. You know, in other words, you know, it's the higher cost is what I meant when I said it's not really that different, is that the numbers change, but the kind of MO hasn't changed that much.
Cora, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure talking.
Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.